From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. After weeks of speculation, President Bush last night chose John Roberts Jr. to replace retiring Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. Roberts is currently a judge in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. On today's Fresh Air, we get insight on Roberts' opinions and legal career from Cass Sunstein, professor of law and political science at the University of Chicago. Also, why video games and TV may be doing just the opposite of rotting our children's brains. We'll talk with writer Stephen Johnson, who says the increased complexity in popular culture is actually sharpening our minds. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. President Bush's nomination of Federal Circuit Court Judge John Roberts to the Supreme Court has touched off the long-anticipated debate over the direction of the court after the departure of Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. Conservatives have praised the Roberts pick, liberal activists have condemned it, and Senate Democrats are reacting cautiously, saying they want to know more about Roberts' judicial philosophy. To discuss Roberts' career, the issues before the court, and the forthcoming confirmation battle, I spoke earlier today with Cass Sunstein, a professor of law and political science at the University of Chicago. Sunstein clerked for Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall and has written widely on legal and constitutional issues. I asked him if he had a sense of how this nomination will be received as the hearings approach.
Too early to say, and that's good. The early reaction on the part of some conservatives, which was to dance and describe this person as extremely wonderful in all ways, that doesn't serve the country entirely well. We should discuss substance a bit before dancing. We should try to figure out something about this person before rushing to condemn or to celebrate. We can and should celebrate his competence. There's no question about that. And his character. There's no question about that. But competence and character are not really what this is about. They're necessary conditions. The question is whether the court is going to be moved in massive directions or not. And we, especially because this is someone who's relatively young and has such a thin public record, we just don't know about that. So I think to wait and try to figure out more about what kind of conservative this guy is the right approach for conservatives, liberals, and moderates alike.
He, of course, has argued, I believe, 39 cases before the court. And, of course, did some rulings as an appellate court judge in Washington. Let's go over his record to the extent you know it. I mean, can you give us a sense of some of the most important cases he has decided as a judge?
I think the most important one involves the Endangered Species Act. And there's a disputed question whether the Endangered Species Act actually is constitutional, whether Congress has the authority to protect endangered species when they're on, say, one landowner's property and there isn't an obvious connection with interstate commerce. Congress, of course, has power over interstate commerce, but it doesn't have general authority to do whatever it thinks best. The majority view in the courts is the Endangered Species Act is constitutional, even if it involves a single landowner with a single species on his property. But Judge Roberts, in a separate opinion, strongly suggested he thought the Endangered Species Act was not constitutional in some of its applications to particular landowners. And in doing that, he really reached out and went beyond the position of a lot of Reagan and Bush appointees. This is a tea leaf, and you can't read a whole lot into it, but I think it's the most important tea leaf there. And it suggests that he's not unwilling to use the power of the federal judiciary to strike down acts of Congress that exceed what he believes are Congress's constitutional powers. And that's a position traditionally associated with, let's say, strong conservatives.
Now, that was a minority opinion he wrote in that case, was it not?
Yes, it was just Judge Roberts and another judge, also very good and also very conservative, that is Judge Sentell. But all the other judges on that court, including a number of Reagan appointees and Bush appointees too, Bush 1, thought that the Endangered Species Act was constitutional. It seems technical, but it's a quite big deal. The Supreme Court has indicated a willingness to strike down acts of Congress, including civil rights acts, as beyond the authority of the national government. That would change constitutional law's fabric in pretty large ways. We don't know from Judge Roberts' overall record whether he's on the train of constitutional change, but that single opinion indicates that he's at least willing to think about it.
Give us a sense of the larger constitutional issue that is at work in this business about the Endangered Species Act. There are conservatives who believe that a return to what they call the Constitution in exile would give us a very different federal government.
Yeah, there are some conservatives who have a pretty extreme program. And what they think is that the real Constitution has been obliterated in the last 50 years, and that since Franklin Delano Roosevelt, at least, the Supreme Court has taken a horrendous wrong turn, and it's time to have some kind of restoration. Sometimes what they say is they want the Constitution roughly as it was in 1920. Sometimes they say they want to interpret the Constitution to mean what it originally meant. That is what it meant at the time it was ratified. When the President of the United States speaks of strict construction, some people think what he's saying is the Constitution should be understood to mean exactly what it meant at the time it was ratified. Now, that view sounds kind of good and innocuous and respectful of the founders, but it would be quite radical. It would mean that, for example, racial discrimination by the national government would be just fine, and sex discrimination by all governments would be just fine. This federalism issue is a way into that, because what a lot of people have objected to, a lot of conservatives, including most loudly the most extreme conservatives, is that Congress's powers should be more sharply disciplined than the court has been willing to do since the 1930s. Now, what this would mean concretely is not only the Endangered Species Act would be in trouble, but also the Clean Water Act and some of its applications would be in trouble. The Americans with Disabilities Act would fall in part, as it already has. The Age Discrimination Act would fall in part, as it already has. The Violence Against Women Act would fall in part, as it already has. Some other laws, including regular civil rights laws, that is the older ones, and the Voting Rights Act, they might be in constitutional jeopardy also. Some of federal criminal law might be in trouble. My guess from this opinion is that Judge Roberts is at least willing to think about the idea that the constitutional train has gone off the rails since 1950 or so. There's no evidence in his record that he's any kind of extremist or revolutionary, but his record's pretty thin. And this opinion does suggest that he's open, at least, to reconsidering or moving the law in directions that are major.
He has spent only 2 years on the appellate court bench deciding these, you know, appellate cases. Do you think it's troubling? Do we need justices with either more judicial experiences or more of a record, which gives us a sense of their own constitutional views?
The good side about Judge Roberts is that this isn't someone who's unfamiliar with issues that come to the Supreme Court. Even though he's only been a judge for 2 years, he has fantastic experience in the world of Supreme Court advocacy, and he really knows what he's doing. So I think we could be worried about someone who's just been a judge for 2 years if they're inexperienced in the issues that the Supreme Court deals with. Then there'd be some competence questions. But for Judge Roberts, there's no competence question at all, and the president really should be complimented for choosing someone who is so obviously qualified. On the other hand, there is the following issue. He's, with respect to the huge issues of the day, he's a bit of a blank check. And that's, in a way, okay, because it suggests he hasn't closed his mind on issues. But what kind of conservative Judge Roberts is remains mysterious. So it's noteworthy that the president didn't choose someone who is established as someone with extreme conservative views, or established as someone without extreme conservative views. He chose and said someone who's very affable, someone who's quite excellent, but someone who we really have very few clues about in terms of what kind of conservative he would be. And some people, I think, conservatives as well as liberals, might be nervous about that.
Is it a political reality of the modern confirmation process that we will get more and more judges with a thin judicial record because there's less to pick apart?
I think so. This was what was said by a lot of Judge Bork's supporters a long time ago. They said, if you go after Judge Bork hard, then presidents are going to have an incentive to appoint people who have no paper trail. And the evidence suggests that that's so. Justice Souter had relatively little paper trail. Justice Thomas had relatively little paper trail. Justice Breyer and Justice Ginsburg both had a pretty long paper trail. They were professors, so paper is what they generate. But it wasn't on the big issues. They were, for the most part, steady, moderate, not noisy people whose views on large issues you couldn't tease out terribly well. You'd know they wouldn't be likely to want to overrule Roe against Wade, but even there, Justice Ginsburg, as Judge Ginsburg, thought to be liberal, was a big critic of Roe against Wade. She said it did too much too soon. So we have had justices who've had a degree of unpredictability. I think what some people concerned about Judge Roberts might worry over is he's publicly unpredictable, but he might be privately predictable. It's possible that the White House knows that this is, let's say, a more extreme conservative than the record suggests.
My guest is University of Chicago law professor Cass Sunstein. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is University of Law professor Cass Sunstein. We're talking about President Bush's nomination of Judge John Roberts to the Supreme Court. Well, let's look at some things beyond his judicial record. One thing we know that he is that he was a member of the Federalist Society, which is a conservative lawyers group that, I mean, a few years back, they were written about as having linked the Ken Starr investigative team with the Paula Jones legal team, and in part helping to generate the Monica Lewinsky scandal. What does Judge Roberts' membership in the Federalist Society tell us?
It tells us he's a conservative. It doesn't tell us that he's an extremist or that he is on some sort of political mission as a judge. The Federalist Society is very large. It's mostly an academic society. There are people who are moderate conservatives there. There are people there who are extremists there. There are people you really couldn't describe as conservative, so extreme are they. There are some people who you have a hard time describing as conservative, so moderate are they. So I think the Federalist Society is a pretty wide tent. It is true that some members are really plugged in to the White House and are highly political and do have an agenda. But the fact that Judge Roberts is a member of the Federalist Society tells us only something I think everyone ought to know, which is that he's a conservative. But that can't be disqualifying.
He is Catholic, said to be a man of faith. His wife, I believe, is active in a pro-life organization. Are those clues, are those insights into his judicial philosophy, are they fair game for the confirmation process?
The fact that he's Catholic certainly is not fair game. And, you know, we've come to a point in this country, I hope and believe, where someone's religious convictions can't be used against them. The fact that his wife is pro-life, if that is a fact, I don't think that's fair game either. I'll tell you what is fair game, which is to ask whether he believes that the Constitution protects her right of privacy, and see what he says about that. Both Justice Thomas and Justice Scalia have suggested not just that they don't like Roe against Wade, but also that they think the Constitution doesn't protect a right of privacy at all. Now, that's a very big deal. That would mean that compulsory sterilization would be okay. It would mean that people don't have a constitutional right to live with other members of their family. It would mean that the government has a right to ban contraceptives. It would revolutionize an area of the law that's been going now for about half a century, and if you count it a certain way, by a century. So it is fair to ask him if he believes in a right to privacy, and if he gives an evasive answer to that question, that can and will be held against him.
He clerked for Justice Rehnquist. He was a protege of Ken Starr. Are there any other professional relationships or components of his experience that would give you insight into his philosophy?
That's a great question. And I think there we do have a few things to learn from. The fact that he's clerked for Chief Justice Rehnquist tells us a little bit. And people who know him say that he and Chief Justice Rehnquist have a terrifically amiable relationship with a lot of compatibility. Now, Rehnquist, like Judge Roberts, is a great guy. So I'm sure that's part of it. But it wouldn't be at all, it wouldn't be wrong, I think, to say that there's an ideological congeniality also between the two. And you know, that's worthwhile knowing. The fact that he's a protege of Judge Starr, who is a very articulate and strong backer of Judge Roberts, is also worth noting. It tells you something. Now, I'd like to say about Judge Starr that when he was on the Court of Appeals, he was a moderate judge. He was not an agenda-driven conservative or an extremist by any means. So if Judge Roberts ends up being the way that Ken Starr was as a judge, then I think all sides should say we have a real judge here and not an extremist. But it is noteworthy that I guess in his background he doesn't have sponsors, at least close sponsors or close colleagues who are on the other side ideologically. It is true that some people who are left of center quite like him and respect him. And from all indications, this is someone who everyone should be willing to like and respect. He's just a good and admirable person. But whether he has the kind of open-mindedness that we saw in Justice O'Connor, a distinctive kind of conservative, the record is very thin. And the fact that he has these particular friends and sponsors doesn't tell us a whole lot.
Well, Cass Sunstein, I wonder if you could briefly take us through some of the major areas of the law that will be confronting the Supreme Court. Are there cases soon that could make new law in areas of abortion rights or affirmative action gun laws?
The court has a case next term involving abortion. And as I recall, it's a case about parental notification or one of the spin-off issues that the court hasn't had to deal with in a long, long time. What's interesting about this is that the court has chipped away a bit at the abortion right. The big headline news has been that the court hasn't eliminated the abortion right, but there's been some definite chipping. And it's expected, given the composition of the court, that at least some chipping will continue. Justice O'Connor wanted to preserve the core of Roe. If Judge Roberts thinks Roe is wrong and an abuse of authority, then we could see the abortion case that the court's about to decide as the basis for pretty significant movement away from Roe, and maybe even an indication that it might be ready to go before terribly long. So that's a big one. Coming down the pike, not immediately, but pretty soon, are cases involving affirmative action, campaign finance, at least at the state level, and property rights. Those are three hardy perennials: campaign finance, affirmative action, and property rights. And the court has spoken to each of them relatively recently, but by very fragmented courts that leave the law quite flexible. It's not at all clear, but it's very possible that Justice Roberts would want to take a very hard line against both affirmative action and campaign finance, and that would have very major effects on the country at both the federal and state levels. For educational institutions, a modest degree of affirmative action is okay. It's possible that that would be eliminated. So too with campaign finance, where the court has not been very excited about campaign finance restrictions.
And what about the issues of homeland security and the way, for example, detainees have been treated?
One that's coming up very soon involves the president's power to create military tribunals to try suspected terrorists. The Court of Appeals in Washington recently said the president does have the authority to use military tribunals to try suspected terrorists. Judge Roberts was on that panel. It may be that he would be disqualified from participation in the case as a result. Even if he is, the president's power to wage the war on terror has produced a very badly fragmented set of decisions from the court, where Justice O'Connor took the lead role, saying the president does have a lot of power here, but there's a constitutional right, which is to fair procedure, and that's kind of a Trump. The right to fair procedure before you're deprived of your liberty. Some of the justices think she overreached and that the president can do very much as he wants if he's trying to protect the nation's security. Justice Roberts undoubtedly will play a key role on that, not just because the court is so badly divided, but also because he combines a lot of quality with a lot of expertise. So he's kind of a specialist in the power of the president.
University of Chicago Law and Political Science Professor Cass Sunstein. His new book is Radicals in Robes, Why Extreme Right-Wing Courts Are Wrong for America. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor Audio Courses, which include Everything You've Been Taught Is Wrong by James Lowen, author of Lies My Teacher Told Me. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, why everything bad is good for you. Steven Johnson contends video games have become more challenging and complex and are actually making our kids smarter. He even thinks television is sharpening our minds. Also, more on last night's Supreme Court nomination with University of Chicago law professor Cass Sunstein. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. As the nation begins to assess President Bush's nominee to the Supreme Court, Federal Circuit Court Judge John Roberts, we've asked Cass Sunstein, a professor of law and political science at the University of Chicago, to help us assess Roberts' record and the coming debate. Earlier this year, the subject of judicial confirmation was fought out in the Senate over whether the filibuster would be preserved. And in the end, a compromise was reached. What does that showdown and the way it was resolved tell us about what we can expect in the Senate?
I think it tells us about the massive power and discipline of the Republican Party. I thought this was a brilliant maneuver to try to threaten to get rid of the filibuster, which has been there for a long, long time, and that the Republicans, in my view, had a smashing victory. The reason they had a smashing victory is they got some of the most controversial people through. They also kept the option of the elimination of the filibuster in reserve. My hunch is the Democratic senators are well aware that any effort to filibuster will trigger talk and maybe the reality of the nuclear option. There's a good chance that the Senate Republicans have the votes to initiate the nuclear option. The Republicans were on message throughout in a way that, by the Democrats' light, confused the issue. So they are very much in the ascendancy now.
That's interesting because I think some Democrats looked at that as a victory for moderates, that they had effectively told the nation that the Republicans were radicals who wanted to overturn a century of tradition and were able to defend the filibuster. You see it differently.
I do. There's an old story of a husband and wife where the husband says about a cake, let me have the whole cake. And the wife says, well, why don't we split it 50-50? And the husband says, well, let's compromise. I get 3/4. I think the Republicans were the husband in that story, except that instead of 3/4, they got maybe 80%. The Democrats are right to say that they maintained the filibuster option, and that's not nothing. And they also did make some fair points about the longevity of the filibuster and its role in the system of separation of powers. But those were kind of academic points.
The confirmation hearings will, of course, attract enormous amount of attention. And there's always a debate or a difference of opinion about what judges should be asked. I mean, there is one view that the court should be governed by law and precedent and weigh each decision that comes before it, and that in that vein, you don't ask judges to speculate about decisions that might be made. And then others say, we need to know where you stand on privacy, on choice, on abortion. What would you ask? What do you think senators should be asking?
I think the first question senators should ask is, do you believe that the Constitution means what it originally meant? Do you believe that the Constitution should be interpreted to mean what it meant in 1789, except insofar as it's been amended? When it's been amended, do you think it should be interpreted to mean what it meant after the Civil War? If the nominee says yes to that question, that seems to me a very bad warning sign, in my view, that justifies follow-up questions. The follow-up questions might ask, for example, do you believe that established precedent should be taken seriously even if it's inconsistent with the understanding from a century or two centuries ago? If the judge says, I would like to go back to the original understanding, but I understand we have a tradition that involves respect for precedent, that means the warning is less troublesome. I also think it's perfectly appropriate to ask a nominee, do you believe that there is a right to privacy in the Constitution? Do you think that, not that Roe against Wade is necessarily right, but do you believe that the privacy notion has validity? And if there's an evasive answer to that question, that's a real problem. I think it's fine to ask a nominee, which decisions of the past 50 years do you dislike most? Now, it's also fine for the nominee to be circumspect about answering that question for fear that some of the decisions of the last 50 years are vulnerable and might be overruled. And if they're still live, then the nominee might not want to take a stand on them. But we can get a big clue about what a nominee thinks by seeing what they like and what they dislike. I don't think nominees should answer questions that would pre-commit them to particular votes on particular issues. So to say, would you vote to overrule Roe against Wade? That's not an illegitimate question, but it's probably wrong to answer it.
When they ask the questions that you think are important and the nominee who has been coached to be evasive is evasive, what should the senator then do?
The senator should hold evasiveness unless it's evasiveness about particular votes against the nominee. The process now has been fantastically scripted, so there are a lot of superb people, I bet, already working with Judge Roberts a little bit, and if not now, soon, to help him, and he is really good, so he doesn't need a tremendous amount of help to evade questions. This is something that the Senate should know about and should be bemused and a little aggressive with. If a nominee says, for example, I'll follow the law, really, that's terrible. That's become the line that nominees give, I'll follow the law. In our system, fortunately, everyone agrees with that. So that tells us nothing. If the nominee talks a lot about Indiana and growing up there and what was learned in the steel mills, that's relevant some, but that's not what the issue should be centering on. So this turning Supreme Court nominees into heroic characters in docudramas, that's been done, and the Senate really shouldn't stand for that. That just evades the issues. So what the Senate is entitled to do is to try to get a sense of the general orientation of the judge, not of specific conclusions. And if the judge refuses to give a sense of the general orientation, that's a definite problem.
You described him as a great guy, well-liked by people from many different perspectives. There's a long history of conservatives being disappointed with nominees who they thought would carry their agenda to the Supreme Court, who in the end didn't. I mean, Justice Kennedy and many others. I mean, I'm wondering if the fact that he seems to be an amiable guy whose opinions don't use inflammatory rhetoric suggests that he's the kind of guy, once he's in a body where many opinions flourish, that he might be more of a consensus builder than conservative backers would hope.
Yeah, it's possible. The history suggests that conservative presidents mostly get conservative justices and they aren't disappointed. So there are a few prominent counterexamples, but the lament that you can't predict whom you're appointing, it actually isn't backed up by history. O'Connor is often said to be someone who disappointed the conservatives, but President Reagan said that in O'Connor, I got exactly what I wanted. So I think the conservatives who've been disappointed by some of these appointments, maybe with Justice Souter, they're right to be, but the court really has shifted very, very dramatically to the right in a short time. With respect to Judge Roberts, if there's going to be a shift, I would guess it would be extremely modest. For one thing, we don't know exactly what he believes, so the confirmation process should be maybe the most interesting one we've had in a long, long time. And for another thing, this is someone who has had a long history of dealing intensely with the most sharply disputed issues of the day. So there's no question that he's thought long and hard against both abortion and privacy. There's no question that he's thought, in some detail at least, about affirmative action. There's no question that he's thought, probably in great detail, about the power of the president. So unlike Justice O'Connor, for example, or Justice Souter, who both came from the state court systems, this is someone who's thought about federal law a lot. So more like Justice Scalia, who hasn't shifted, and Justice Thomas, who hasn't shifted, and Chief Justice Rehnquist, who on hardly anything has shifted significantly. All three of those had a lot of intense experience with federal law in the executive branch of federal government. So I wouldn't expect this to be someone who would disappoint President Bush.
Well, Cass Sunstein, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
University of Chicago Law and Political Science Professor Cass Sunstein. His new book is Radicals in Robes, Why Extreme Right-Wing Courts Are Wrong for America. Coming up, writer Stephen Johnson says popular culture is making us smarter. This is Fresh Air. Try and tell a bunch of moms and dads that video games and television shows are making our kids smarter, and you're probably going to get an argument. But my guest, writer Stephen Johnson, says exactly that in his new book, Everything Bad is Good for You. Johnson says that while it's common to hear popular culture has been dumbed down, much of it is more mentally challenging than it was 20 years ago, and that is sharpening our minds. And he says his case is borne out by rising IQ scores. Johnson writes about emerging technology for Discover magazine and contributes to Slate, Wired, and the New York Times magazine. We last spoke to him about his book, Mind Wide Open, Your Brain and the Neuroscience of Everyday Life. In his new book, Johnson says there's a lot adults don't know about modern video games.
For parents who are worried about these games, the first thing I would encourage you to do is to sit down and try and play them with your kids, because what you'll find is that they're extremely difficult. Most of them take an amazing amount of thinking and problem solving and pattern recognition. You have to really focus and engage with what's going on the screen. It's not just about hand-eye coordination. It's not just about shooting things as quickly as you can. And you'll find, actually, when you play these games with your kids that, they are very sophisticated at solving these problems, and you will have a lot more trouble than they will. And I think one of the things that happens is that you start to realize that there's a lot more kind of mental labor going on in these games than we give them credit for. I mean, the basic element of all this that's really worth stressing is that at every moment of every video game that's ever been made, really, you have to make decisions. You have to exercise the part of the mind that makes decisions based on available information. You look at the situation in the game, you think about what's happened over the last 30 minutes, the last hour, you think about patterns that you've recognized in the game, you think about your objectives, the resources you have, your long-term goals, your short-term goals. You synthesize all of that information, and you make a choice. You make a decision about the best strategy going forward. Now, that is I can't think of a more kind of basic definition of what it means to be smart than the ability to make decisions on the fly based on available information and get feedback from the world telling you whether that was the right decision or the wrong one.
I was talking with a parent about this who said, but okay, maybe they get us better at making decisions and thinking about spatial relationships, but is there any real intellectual workout? I mean, are you dealing with things other than kind of how objects interact spatially? Give us an example, maybe from a video game that illustrates.
Absolutely. I mean, let's look at the most popular PC game of all time, The Sims, where you manage a virtual family, you have a household, you have a bunch of different kind of characters whose lives you're kind of controlling in some way, even though the characters kind of have a life of their own, which is part of the magic of the game. And when you're managing that game, basically, you can steer these characters in any direction you want. You can try and build a large family and build a giant house, or make them happy professionally, or make them happy romantically, or throw a giant party for the neighborhood, or do any number of things that you want to do with their lives. But what's happening at that moment in the game is a huge number of, it's what you sometimes might call a multivariable problem, in the sense that there are literally dozens and dozens and dozens of kind of variables that are changing over time in the game. So you have the different drives of all the characters. Like, you get to see when one of your characters is hungry or needs sleep or needs to have some social time. You see how those characters are interacting. You can see all their different relationships with all the people in the neighborhood. You can see all their kind of career issues and how much money is coming in and how much money is going out. And you can see their romantic issues and all these different variables. And you're trying to track all of that at the same time. Now, that's, in fact, not really a spatial issue at all. I mean, there is some kind of spatial sense that you have to make of the environment. But mostly you're thinking about all these different kind of issues and emotional needs of all these different characters. You're managing it. You're synthesizing it. You're putting it all together. And you're coming up with a strategy based on your vision of what you want that world to be like. Now, that is a really profound way of thinking. I mean, it's taking place in this kind of cartoon-like universe, but you're actually doing a kind of problem-solving that turns out to be really useful in real life when you apply it to real people as well. So it's not just about you know, trying to visually remember things or just keep track of images as they fly by on the screen.
You make the point that there's something about video games that engages the way our brains are wired, something the way the brain responds to mental reward. Explain that.
The idea is basically that there's a system sometimes called the seeking circuitry of the brain, which is related to the neurotransmitter dopamine. And basically, the human brain is wired to in a sense, anticipate reward. And when reward, in whatever form it takes, whether it's in the form of money or sex or power or little symbolic rewards of the video game world, when the reward that you're expecting doesn't kind of show up in quite the quantity that you expected, your brain is kind of wired to want to explore your environment, to seek out the reward that kind of didn't show up when it was promised. That's why this is a term that the neuroscientist Yak Panksepp calls, this is why he calls it a seeking circuitry. You want to explore and find the thing you're missing. So the argument is that a cultural form, this is the argument that I make in the book, a cultural form that involves excessive displays of reward or the promise of reward coupled with exploration will be a very powerful kind of cocktail for the human brain. And in fact, that's exactly what you find in video games. In a sense, video games are always telling you, okay, you can get to the next level and then you'll get this special prize, or you'll be able to build this new building, or you'll, you know, your character will be able to finally fall in love with the character next door if you do the following things. And so many of the games involve moving around a physical space and turning corners and mapping a large kind of terrain. Grand Theft Auto, for instance, is a great example of that. It's a huge city that you have to map. And so I think that that's one of the key factors in why video games are so powerful, and in fact why kids will get pulled into them and be willing to put up with all the work that they have to do mentally to play these games, is because it activates this kind of seeking circuitry in the brain.
My guest is Stephen Johnson. His book is called Everything Bad is Good for You. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Stephen Johnson. His new book, Everything Bad is Good for You, makes an argument that today's popular culture is actually making us smarter rather than dumber. Well, Stephen Johnson, surely you're not going to tell us that television programs these days are more mentally engaging than they used to be.
I'm afraid I am. No, I think one of the general points here is that I think that this process of the kind of cognitive workout that I'm talking about is being led by the interactive media. So it's the games and the internet and email and the participatory forms that you really have to make decisions and be engaged in. And what has happened with television is, in a sense, that television has had to play catch up. So while I think the games may be making us smarter, I think it's more fair to say that television is getting smarter. And that's, I believe, partially because the generation that has grown up, you know, playing some of these incredibly complex games, if you sat those kids down in front of, you know, your average, you know, sitcom from the late 70s in front of, you know, Three's Company or something like that, they'd be bored stiff. They've grown up expecting to be challenged mentally by their media, by their entertainment. And so television has had to kind of deliver some of that challenge for the first time, or the first time in, you know, in kind of big pop mass forms. And so what you see on TV is a whole host of shows that are far more complex in terms of the kind of thinking that you have to do to keep track of what's happening on the screen. So everything from The Sopranos to Alias to Lost to 6 Feet Under, to 24. All these shows have incredibly complicated narrative structures that if you'd put them on the air 30 years ago, people just would not have known what to make of them.
Give us an example of a show from the 60s or 70s and how it's different from and less mentally challenging than programs today.
Well, one of the things I do in the book is kind of chart the narrative structure, because this is a key part of the kind of thinking that you do when you make sense of stories. When you have a single plot line that involves, you know, a handful of characters following one narrative thread, there's simply kind of less going on. You have to do less cognitive work than in what they sometimes call a multi-threaded narrative, like The Sopranos, where there are multiple plot lines. And so I have these kind of charts in the book that are just a sample of what it looks like, but basically from Dragnet to Starsky and Hutch to Hill Street Blues to The Sopranos. And what you see is basically over that time that you basically have a single narrative thread, and this would be true of, you know, most of the shows in that period. In Dragnet, there's just basically one plot. And Starsky and Hutch, there's, you know, a little joke plot at the beginning where, you know, Starsky gets a funny haircut or something like that. And then, you know, the story breaks out and they have to chase the criminal for the whole episode. And then at the end, the joke plot kind of reappears where Hutch gets a haircut or whatever it is. You know, there's some little funny riff that happens. But basically, it's, you know, one plot with these two little bookends. And then you get to Hill Street Blues. And Hill Street Blues introduces, in kind of serious drama, this multi-threaded format. And Hill Street Blues would often have, you know, six or seven separate plots, really two or three dominant ones and two or three kind of secondary ones, but it would still have much more going on. Now, here's the interesting thing. Hill Street Blues comes out with this structure. It's the most complicated show on television in 1981. It's also the most critically, you know, well-received show on television. The critics just love it. Everybody says it's the best thing on TV. And it is a complete flop the first year. It is literally too hard for the audiences of the day to understand. There's simply too much going on.
All right, so television has given us The Sopranos and ER and shows that are mentally challenging and have complex plot lines. Television has also given us Survivor and these dumb reality shows. I mean, is that an improvement?
If you're talking about a trend, you have to be fair in making comparisons. So I agree that the reality shows that are popular today are not the best things on television. But to compare them to where we were 30 years ago, you can't compare them to, you know, Mary Tyler Moore or to MASH. You have to compare them to the mediocre shows from 30 years ago. I mean, the reality shows are basically game shows, right? I mean, they're basically, you know, contestants, you know, struggling, competing for prizes. So the question is Survivor, is The Apprentice, you know, more challenging and interesting than, you know, Wheel of Fortune or The Price is Right or Battle of the Network Stars? because that's what was going on equivalently, you know, in the late 70s. And in fact, I would say clearly that The Apprentice and Survivor are better than those shows. In the book, I talk a little bit about why they are, which is that they involve this kind of, you know, psychological gameplay. They do tend to have a lot of characters, Survivor, The Apprentice. There's lots of different relationships. There's kind of a social network that you have to map and keep track of to follow the shows. I think to some extent that's been misinterpreted as me saying, you know, that watching Survivor, you know, boosts your IQ, which I do not believe at all. But it is, I think, why those shows are better than the, you know, the kind of worst shows of yesteryear. So that, you know, even in the kind of middle or bottom of the barrel, the quality is improving.
Your book largely focuses on the mental exercise that popular culture gives us and says that it's making our brains work harder. You don't address in any depth the argument that pop culture is morally inferior, that we've gone, there's way too much graphic sex and violence and depravity. What is your view of that? I mean, if it's giving us a good mental working out, is it giving it us sort of a, is it degrading us morally?
Yeah, what I tried to do in the book is to put that question of values and morals aside for the bulk of the book, because frankly, there are a thousand, you know, op-eds about that question and books written every year. We have an existing big debate about the values question and whether, you know, Janet Jackson and the Super Bowl and The Sopranos are leading to this coarsening of the culture and Howard Stern, or whether it's all right. And I felt like that's an important conversation to have, and thankfully, we're having that conversation, but it's incomplete unless you talk about the other side, the side of kind of increased cognitive complexity. If your only way of evaluating the impact of culture is purely to look at the values, I think you're missing a huge part of the story. And so I said, listen, with this book, I'm not going to talk about the values. I'm going to focus on this, and other people can talk about the values, and you can decide after you've read my book whether you think, in the end, the increased complexity is worth the trade-off of maybe more violence or more obscenity or more sex. So I think, you know, sometimes people feel like I'm kind of dodging the issue there, but I'm explicitly saying, look, I'm not going to deal with the issue, and you know that conversation is already happening out there. The one thing I will say, though, is that, you know, I think, for instance, with the violence question, there have been a lot of, you know, articles and essays and hand-wringing about the issue of violence. And there's no question that the games and the TV shows have gotten more explicitly violent, you know, in terms of the bloodshed and the gore that you see over the last 10 years or so. But there's also no question that during that period, we have lived through the single most dramatic drop in violent crime, particularly among young people, in the country's history. So whatever the effects of fictional media violence are on real-world violence, they are, by definition, you know, much smaller than all the other social effects that you know, transform or accelerate or diminish violence in the society at large. So I think we tend to exaggerate the impact of media violence on real world violence, and that's what I think the numbers show from the last 10 years.
Well, Stephen Johnson, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Writer Stephen Johnson. His new book is Everything Bad Is Good for You. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Roberta Shorrock, and Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, Sam Brigger, and Mike and Scott. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Bantam Books, publisher of The Water Room, a Bryant and May mystery set in London, by Christopher Fowler, author of Full Dark House. And from V2 Records, presenting the White Stripes' new CD, Get Behind Me, Satan, available at Barnes & Noble and barnesandnoble.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Juicing the Game, Howard Bryant writes about sports for the Boston Herald. His new book is about the past decade in baseball, when so many big hitters turned to steroids that even minor leaguers felt pressured to take them. Also, a look inside the turbulent White House press room with veteran reporter Helen Thomas. Join us for the next Fresh Air.